Do you believe there is a God who is infinitely powerful, who is with you every moment of every day, who will lead you, who will care for you? And if you do, then wow, you are in excellent shape. Because really that's the story of Ruth. It's the story of a family who are gonna wrestle with that exact thing. Is he really for us? Is he really there? Is he really leading? Even in the things that seem to just so happen. That's kind of one of the great statements of Ruth chapter 2. It just so happened. And the author of Ruth wants you to, he wants you to kind of catch your toe on that statement and have to say, is that how I view life? That it's just a series of things that just so happen? Or do I actually think there is a God who is leading me? A long time ago, in a faraway place, I started a brief three-part look at Naomi in this series that we've been doing of the B-side characters, kind of the lesser known or kind of obscure. They're not the ones that often get kind of the headlines. Of course, in the book called Ruth, Ruth is the one that we typically think of as this is the key character. And if you remember back to, I was 4 weeks ago when we started looking at the story, I said there's kind of a bit of an ironic twist to it, because if you looked at just the content of the book, it's actually mainly about Naomi. The book of Ruth is actually a wonderful book. Please read it sometime if you never have. But just know this, as you read it, to read it properly, you have to pay attention to the dialogue. Different than any other book in Scripture. Most books of Scripture that are like narratives that have sort of a storyline of characters, there's different ones. Some are wisdom and some are Psalms and those kind of things. But the narrative type ones often involve both dialogue and the action of the plot line, if that makes sense. But Ruth wants you to pay attention to what's going to be said. In fact, over half the verses, or actually over half the words, I think it is, are actually dialogue. In other words, there are people talking, there are conversations happening, and over three quarter of the verses contain dialogue. Oddly so, in fact, the actual events of the book are usually moved over really quickly. You almost shockingly so. Like if you think of the first few verses of chapter one, where we were a few weeks ago, you have epic things happening in the life of this family. A woman named Naomi, her husband named Elimelech, whose name means God is my king, which should cause us kind of a crisis. When the man whose name God is my king, a few verses in, is dead, it should kind of lead us going, hey, what kind of a book is this? When that man loses his life, kind of right in chapter 1, verse 4. But it's actually in some ways worse than that. If you think of the plot line of those first few verses, there's a famine in a place called Bethlehem, which is the home for Naomi and Elimelech and their two sons. And the irony of it is that Bethlehem means house of bread. There's a famine. There's no more bread in the place where it should be plentiful. And so that crisis leads to the next crisis, which is that this family moves to Moab, presumably because there's at least bread there, but there's not God there, because the Jewish people knew that God had called them to that land. That was to be their home. And they were instructed very clearly not to leave it. That was where they were to dwell, because that's where their God was going to meet them. But this family goes to Moab, which I undoubtedly think of as crisis number two. They arrive in Moab, and pretty quickly thereafter, you can see again the third crisis. And it's kind of a peculiar one, because Elimelech and Naomi's sons, both marry Moabite women. And if you've raised families and you've had kids sort of into those high school years, there's probably a point in there where I hope you started praying for their spouse to come. And you probably had hopes or ideas. And I hope among that is like, I hope my son or daughter finds a godly spouse who loves Jesus. If you've got kids in that zone, be praying to that end. But Naomi's sons both marry Moabites. And I don't know, because we're not told, again, just kind of how that landed in Naomi's world. But it feels like it was probably not a joyful, wonderful thing. Crisis number four, her husband dies. And literally, that's as much as you're told. Then Elimelech dies. And we move on to the next crisis, which is two sons and their wives live 10 years and there are no kids. And in the ancient world, that alone is another crisis. And it leads to the sixth crisis, which is not only do they not have kids, both her sons die. And literally in the first, five or six verses, you get that whole chaotic crisis unfolding in the life of Naomi. Like, no wonder a few verses later, she's going to say, you want to know what? I came here full and I'm going home empty. God has made me bitter. Never wavering in her doubt there is a God, just pretty convinced that God was not necessarily just going to leave a wonderful full life. In fact, very much convinced the opposite. Now, the rest of chapter one is a long conversation, essentially, between Naomi and her two daughter-in-laws. See, on the way, her daughter-in-laws start leaving with her, and then she sends them home. It's like, I've got nothing for you. There is not any good reason why you would come with me to Bethlehem. So you just go back to Moab. And if you remember the conversation, probably one of the most famous conversations in the entire book of Ruth is a conversation where Ruth responds to that and gives this beautiful, amazing speech. You remember it? It's like, I'm not going home. I'm going to go with you. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. And your God will be my God. And where you die, I will die. That is an amazing commitment. Like, spectacular. And I hope you, in the pursuit of relationship, find people where you can make those kind of commitments. It's like, I'm all in. I find that an amazing thing, especially in light of the fact that really the way Naomi has taught Ruth about who her God is unique, right? It's like, my God took everything away and I am empty. And Ruth's like, I'm all in. Which, there's a few lessons. Don't ever be afraid to share your faith, even when things are hard, because God can take that and he can still accomplish great things. But we looked at that part of the story a number of weeks ago on Mother's Day, if you remember, and I tried to pull a few kind of pieces together for our moms and said things like this, like, never underestimate the influence of a mom, even when things are hard. Like, it's so easy to underestimate it, but don't do it. Never lose sight of the faith sort of guiding aspect of motherhood, even if we're not talking biological kids. Because at this point in the story, there's no biological family left, right, for Naomi. She's got a daughter-in-law. That's it. And yet she still very much has influence, even in the middle of her difficulty and suffering. I said this, that God often restores in unexpected ways. And so if you're looking and saying, he didn't do what I thought he was going to do, therefore there's no hope, there's no sense of restoration, never count God out. Because the final thing, and this is, I think, the big lesson that Ruth, the book of Ruth, wants you to know, God is working even when he seems silent. If you look at your life and say, God is just silent in my world, it does not mean God is not working. See, the thing I love about the book of Ruth is that it's written for people who live, I think, very much the kind of lives we live, where we can look at the Old Testament and it's full of, or New Testament, full of these awesome miracles. It's like, well, my life's not full of awesome miracles. My life's full of ordinary type of things. And yet God's hand is still at work. Yes, God works through supernatural things, but Ruth almost lets us believe that we could have lived this life. In fact, some of you probably feel it. It's like, actually, I can identify with Naomi, where it's just like one thing after another, and I just keep wondering, why does the hardship get distributed the way it does, where I just got way more than my fair share? But if you've ever had that thought, it's like, oh man, I would like you to meet Naomi this morning. Because she is going to teach us something spectacular about God. It's for people who wonder whether integrity is actually worth it. Or actually living out my faith, even when it's not easy, is it worth it? And it's a story for people who wonder, could anything great come out of such an ordinary life? And God's answer is absolutely. Absolutely. So, chapter 2. In fact, I think, if you remember, I think where I ended in the previous message a number of weeks ago was with a kind of an offhanded comment that chapter 1 ends at a point where if I was to create a Ruth mini-series like on TV, This is such an awesome ending of episode one. Naomi comes back. Everything is empty and bitter, and Ruth is there with her, and they're coming up a dusty road, and you can see Bethlehem just in the distance, and the barley crop, it's just swaying in the breeze. And there's something amazing about this moment, because it's kind of like the hint that there's something good around the corner, but you don't quite see it yet, because that's what hopelessness does to us. It blinds us to the very truths that we're talking about, that God is still at work. We just can't see it. And there's this barley blowing in the wind as they come up the street to Bethlehem. Riley read for us from chapter 2, those first 12 verses. I want to just point out a couple things along the way as we consider this scene that's about to unfold. Now, chapter 1 told us that there was no Redeemer. Let me just make sure we all understand this concept. This will be really helpful for what's coming next. So just a little aside for a minute. The concept of a Redeemer in Scripture, probably you've heard that term, because we often use it in kind of connection with Jesus. He's our Redeemer. It's actually a technical term from the Old Testament. You can read about it in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. The Hebrew word is goel, which it roughly means in English a Redeemer. But what is a Redeemer? A Redeemer is someone who buys something back, right? So if something has been, I've never gone into a pawn shop, so I could be dead wrong on this. Here's how I imagine it works, right? You go in, you put your thing down, you can come back and buy it back later. Am I totally off on this? No one's nodding. It's like none of us have a clue. I watched that Pawn Star thing once or twice. I have the vague recollection. That's sort of how it works. The person who comes and buys it back, you're redeeming it. You're buying it back. Now, in the Old Testament, this often showed up when there was a death in the family. Okay, this is really, really important to understand how this works. So imagine a family. They've got a number of sons, particularly Old Testament time, and one son gets married, and then he dies. He's left behind a widow. Now, if he didn't have kids, it's a crisis moment in the Old Testament because you needed a son to pass along the family property who would be able to, you know, work and care and sustain the family. So the next brother typically would be the goel. He would be the redeemer of the family. He would marry the widow. They would have a son, and that son would actually be considered his now deceased brother's child, so that the name could carry on, the family property could be kept intact. A few things had to happen for a person to function as a redeemer. There's three. Number one, he had to be a close relative. You couldn't just sign up and it's like, well, I have no family connection. You didn't qualify. You had to be a relative. Number two, you had to be willing. You couldn't be forced into it. And number three, you had to be able to redeem the thing that needed to be redeemed. So oftentimes there's a financial piece to this, because you can imagine in a world where there's no social system, safety net, and if a man died and can no longer provide for his family, didn't take long for the widow to be in a financial crisis. And so there would be a financial component of buying her out of a debt or paying for the property to be restored to her. So those are the three components, which is really interesting. I hope you'll connect the dots, and I might later if we have time, to what Jesus did for us. If he's our Redeemer, you know, you just think of those three things. Had to be related, so he took on flesh, right? It's all part of God's incredible design, so that he would be able to step in and redeem us. He had to be willing, and we're told in Scripture he was. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross. And he had to be able to pay the price. And what would it cost to redeem you and me? It's like the life of a perfect sacrifice. And so he is the Redeemer. But in this story, in chapter 1, Naomi has essentially said, Ruth and Orpah, the other daughter-in-law, like, you might as well stay in Moab. There is no Redeemer. There's no hope. There's nothing coming back in Bethlehem. Which is what makes verse 1 so interesting. Remember the barley blowing in the breeze? And you're like, is there hope? Like, what's going on in the story? It seemed like so empty. And now there's this barley harvest starting. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband. We didn't even know this man existed. There is a relative. And he's a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech. And his name was Boaz. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, comes this redeemer potential. Someone who can bring hope back to the story. But we don't want to get there too quick, because there's sort of some issues that have to get worked out first. Now, we're going to meet him over these next number of verses. So let me just jump down to, I'll just quickly work through verse 2, 3, as Ruth says to Naomi, I'm going to go and glean in the fields. I'm going to go pick up sort of the leftover crops that got left after the harvest so we have something to eat. And we're told, so she gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was the clan of Elimelech. In my Bible, in verse 3, I have underlined, just so happened. Because I think what the author of Ruth wants you to do is chew on that statement a little bit. Do you believe anything in your life just so happens? I have heard so many, what humanly speaking, sound just like the most crazy stories that often start with, I was in the lineup at Superstore, you'll never believe who came up next. Like, does it just so happen? You know, I bought a house, you'll never believe who my neighbor is. I sold a car, you'll never believe who showed up to buy it. I ended up enrolling in a class, you're never gonna believe who my professor is. Like life just keeps throwing this out. I told the early service this story. I'll try to tell it quickly. Of one of my you'll just never believe moments. I'm gonna leave out details, but just to get to the point. I had this moment in my life where I decided, you know, in the pastoral world, job searches are a bit of a weird animal. But I just remember hitting a point where it's like, I don't need to consider every opportunity that comes along. Not that there were that many. I told the first service, I was also like the bottom of the barrel pastor in many occasions, which I'm totally fine with. But I know you're laughing. It's like false humility. It's like my first church, they actually looked at 4 candidates. The other 3 said no. I was the only one left. Like, true story. So I hit this point. It's like, you know what? If someone phones up, I don't actually have to say I'll pray about it or think about it, because that's just going to unsettle my heart. So the answer will just be no. So you want to know how I ended up here? So I'm in my office in Ontario. I'm there with 3 of my elders. The phone rings. It's a woman from a search team in Maple Ridge, BC. And my answer would have been, under every other circumstance, no. I don't even have to pray about it. But now there's 3 elders in the office hearing half of a conversation that is incredibly awkward. And so I'm trying to get her off the phone. Maybe I've told you this story before. And so I say to her, fine, I'll pray about it. And hang up. Okay, so later in the day, the prayer literally goes something like this. I'm not kidding. God, this is me praying about this thing that I clearly know the answer to is no. But just because I said I was going to pray, now we've done it. Later that day, I'm like, oh man, that's probably not how you should pray about things. We're actually going to spend 10 weeks this summer. Look at the prayers of scripture that's coming up in July. And so later that day, I prayed again and thought, you know what? Okay. I said I would pray. I got to actually do that. And I reached out, not only prayed, I reached out to one of my mentors who said, yeah, no, that's not what you should do. I'm like, whew, good. Apologies to our Maple Ridge crew. It was not your church, by the way. I never wanted to move to Maple Ridge. So I was quite relieved. But then my mentor says, but there's another church, and he told me the name of the church. Their pastor's about to retire probably in 2 years. When that one comes open, you actually need to pray about that one. I'm like, okay, 2 years, not far enough in the future. It just seems kind of, sure, whatever. That pastor had a health crisis 2 months later. That church then called. I'm like, oh my goodness. They picked another guy. I kid you not, bottom of the barrel. That's kind of my claim to fame. Within 2 weeks of that, Doug Halverson, who was sitting in the early service, phones me up. I don't know Doug from, like, hole in the ground. He said, would you consider coming to Emmanuel Vernon? I went from what would have been no, because that's just the settled conviction of my heart, and God just worked. And it just so happened that those events lined up within about 2.5 months. I'm convinced that God is always at work in your life. Always. There's not a day. You sang it this morning. That's why I said, if you just believe that song, the God of angel armies, the Lord of hosts, is always by my side, and he leads me, then you're already where Naomi is about to get. So it just so happened that Ruth arrives at the field of Boaz, who just so happens to be the one redeemer at this point that we know about, who just so happens to not only be there and related. He's also a worthy man. He also happens to be a man of means. He's got fields. So he's related, right? We're going through the checklist. What does he need to be? He needs to be related. He needs to be willing, which we get to later. And he needs to have the means. He's like, check, check. It's like, we've got a candidate. And not only that, he's a godly man. You see that again, just in the dialogue. Just when you read Ruth, pay attention to the dialogue, because by the time you get to a verse like verse 4, it's like, why would the author of Ruth tell you the interaction between him and the men who are reaping out in his field, his employees? Like, it's totally incidental to the whole story. You could take verse 4 out. It's like, is the way he greets them significant to the plot line? Only this: when he greets them, here's what he says: the Lord be with you. And what's their reply? And the Lord bless you. Because not only is he a worthy man, not only is he a man of means, he's a man who is concerned with the things of God. So much so that the first thing out of his lips when he has a chance to talk to the men working out in his field is not, how is the crop coming? How is production? How much did we get off the... It's, hey, I want the Lord to bless you. And what's their response? A freedom, because they know he's a man of faith, to say, and the Lord bless you as well. That's an awesome moment. Okay, moving a little bit faster through the story so we don't run out of time. There's a conversation about Ruth, and so now Boaz is starting to be alerted to who this young woman is, which sets the stage for verse 9. When Boaz said to Ruth, the conversation going on, now listen, my daughter, which is a weird, it's a little bit weird later. Remember, he's related, he's got the means, and we're gonna find out who he's willing. He doesn't know at this point what's about to go down, which is probably why he calls her his daughter, because that's not the most romantic way to begin a relationship. Anyway, that's a tip if you're thinking of dating. Don't start there. But here's what he says. Don't go to another field or leave this one. Keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? When you're thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn. Verse 10, then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and she said to him, my second underlined in chapter 2, why have I found favor in your eyes? Pretty interesting comment. She doesn't presume. It's like, well, I ought to, like, everyone ought to just think about me and care for me. She's such an amazing example of a woman of faith. Like, she is astonished at how good he's treating her, not presuming. But she asks this really, really important question, and Boaz will answer in verse 11. You see it. But Boaz answered her, and then he's going to say something that takes you all the way to the end of verse 12. And the next time Boaz stops speaking, it's because Ruth responds and says, then she said, I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, although I am not one of your servants. Between verse 11 and 12, we're going to get Boaz's answer to a very simple seeming question that Ruth asked, why have I found favor in your eyes? And if you pay attention to it, you realize Boaz is going to answer that, and he's going to take one more step. He's also going to answer her this question, and why have you found favor in God's eyes? She doesn't ask it, but he's going to answer it. So here's his answer. Verse 11, Boaz answered her, all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. Makes sense, right? If you heard of a woman, just upstanding character, who initiates going out to work hard in the fields to care for a woman that she has committed herself to with no apparent thought to herself. There was no scheme of like, I'm going to commit myself to Naomi because her star is shooting up, you know, and everything is going to go up and to the right and it's going to be awesome. There's no trace of awesome in this journey. And Boaz says, I heard about what you've done. And now I have a chance to do something for a young woman like that. Ruth, that's the answer to why have I found favor? Because that's what character looks like. And that's what integrity looks like. Doing the right thing, even costly things, when it doesn't seem like there's going to be any advantage. He's like, so you can glean in my fields, unharassed. He'll actually, a little bit later, when he instructs his men, he says to them, it's like, not only let her glean, but when you're harvesting, I want you to take some of your harvest and just drop it. Don't let her notice. Just leave extra because we're going to care for her. Why? Because of what she's done. But notice his answer isn't done. I read to the end of verse 11. He's going to keep talking. Now he's going to talk about the Lord. You notice how that happens? Look, now he says, and the Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward will be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel. So he says, Ruth, it's not just about me. The Lord also has seen this whole thing. And he also knows what's going on. Now, if we're to stop there, we actually have some crazy messed up theology. Because if that's where the story ended, here's what I think we'd have to conclude Boaz's theology works out like. If you work hard for God, he will repay you by blessing you. It's kind of like an employment situation. You go to work, show up at time, do what the boss told you to do. At the end of the day, you get a paycheck. That's not mercy. That's just expected. And that's what Boaz's theology, if we were to stop right there, sounds like. Ruth, you did the right things. You sacrificed yourself to care for Naomi. I have seen, I'm going to let you glean, and God has seen, and he's going to bless you. But he's not done. He actually has one more incredibly important statement to make. So important that in chapter 3, when we get there, Ruth has had those words so imprinted on her heart. They're the words that she will use when she speaks to Boaz in the late night conversation that they're going to have in the next part of the story. But listen to what he says to her last. I'm back up. The Lord repay you for what you have done. A full reward will be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Okay, that changes everything. That's not, Ruth, God saw what you did, and so he's going to pay you back. That is a very different statement. That is, Ruth, I'm aware that you have thrown yourself on the mercy of God. You have essentially concluded that you are helpless and on your own hopeless. You cannot stand on your own two feet. You cannot stand in your own merit. And so you have said, I am instead going to trust this God who she didn't grow up knowing about. She's a Moabite. Naomi gave her a crash course in this God can take everything away from you and leave you bitter and empty. But you have thrown yourself under his wings and have come to take refuge. This is not about God repaying you. This is about God saying, anyone who comes to me and throws themselves on my mercy, I'm going to care for. There's a reason I am absolutely convinced of that. You remember we get to the end of Ruth in chapter 4, and we find out that Ruth is going to eventually have a child. His name will be Obed. He will have a child whose name will be Jesse. He will have a child whose name will be David. Remember the king, the writer of the Psalms? David writes a psalm, Psalm 57, verse 1. It is at a moment in his life where there was almost everything against him. He's running for his life and hiding in a cave. And let me read you what he writes. Be merciful to me, O God, be merciful. For in you my soul takes refuge. In the shadow of your wings I will take refuge till the storms of destruction pass by. Did you catch the logic? The four in this statement? Like he's singing a song of praise, but as he's singing, he's teaching us theology. Be merciful, O God. Four. Here's the reason. Why does David think God will be merciful to him? Because I have taken refuge under your wings. You get the logic? It's not, be merciful to me, for I have done a whole lot of things for you. That's not David's basis of appealing to God. He's like, be merciful for me, to me, for I have realized I am desperately needy and I have decided you're trustworthy. And so I have thrown all my hope on you. And he's like, that's why I believe you will be merciful to me in the future. I don't know, but I kind of wonder, did Ruth take her little baby boy and set him down on her knee and say, once upon a time, your daddy told me this, that the reason he cared for me, the reason he knew God was going to show me favor was because I had thrown myself under his wings. And Obed told his son, and his son told his son. I don't know. But man, the lyrics of Psalm 57, verse 1 sure sound, exactly like the thing that Boaz repeats and says to Ruth, here's the answer to your question. Why have you found favor with me? And more importantly, why have you found favor with God? It's not because of what you do for him. It's because you trust him. You see, that's a lesson for all of us, because that's not just like for one person at one point in history. That's just who God is and how he works. And if you're sitting here this morning and say, what is the path forward? Like, what does a life of faith look like? That's it right there. Throw yourself under his wing. Don't try to tell him some great story of how awesome a person you are and how much you bring to the table. Just set all that stuff aside and say, God, I'm pretty messed up. I can't stand on my own. And the reason I come to you is because I think you can care for me. And Boaz says, that's what God loves. That's why he is showing you favor. Now, the scene continues. Let's carry on with some of these conversations. So Boaz is now showing her favor through his men, and she is gleaning. In fact, she comes back with so much that Naomi notices. In fact, there's sort of an interesting moment. They actually have lunch, and Boaz actually feeds her from what they have, and there's so much. Not only does she eat enough, there's actually leftovers, and she brings the leftovers home. And so by the time we get to verse 17, we read that she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, which was about an ephah of barley, and she took it up and went to the city. And her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned, and she brought out the leftovers, the food she had left over after being satisfied. And her mother-in-law said to her, where on earth did you glean today? Like, what is going on here? Because this is not normal. I added some of those last words, but you see the question. Where did you glean today? Where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you. And we know the man, right? We're looking onto this whole scene going, this is such an amazing story. He's the Redeemer. And he's the man whose field she just so happened into. Just like all those moments in your life where it just seemed like just things happened, you suddenly realized that God was at work. And so Ruth said, the man's name with whom I work today is Boaz. And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, it's like the light comes on. You know, you get that feeling of like, Boaz, right. It all makes sense. And so here's what Naomi says. May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. And then Naomi said to her, the man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers. Needs to be a close relative, needs to be willing, needs to have the means. And if he's gonna be those three things, this is the game-changing moment in the book of Ruth. Again, 4 weeks ago, whatever, I said the book of Ruth has a really nice, simple plot line. There is a prologue, verse, you know, 1 to 5. There's an epilogue, the ending of chapter 4. Then there are two parts to it. Each starts with a crisis and then has a resolution. So there's a crisis, a resolution, a crisis, a resolution, epilogue, the ending of the story. Crisis number one is there's no food. That is a significant crisis. The resolution of it is Ruth ends up in the field, just so happens to be in the field of Boaz, who commits to basically caring for her and providing. Crisis solved. Right? Wonderful. Crisis number two is this issue of, but who will be there for the long haul? All of a sudden we look and it's like, hold everything. We have the guy. Spoiler alert from when we'll be here next time, which will be 2 weeks. In chapter 3, Boaz, who is able and he's related, says, there's one closer. There's a relative closer than me. And we need to check with him first. Like, that is a terrible part of the story, by the way. If you know the story of the book of Ruth, you know that he's not willing in the end. And we're like, yes. You notice when you read that, it's super interesting. When the other guy actually agrees, sorry, we'll get to this, but the other guy agrees he's going to redeem the property and all that stuff. And then Boaz adds in this. And oh, by the way, when you redeem back the property, you also have to redeem back Ruth the Moabite. You hear what he's doing? He doesn't say, Ruth, the beautiful young woman of upstanding character and courage and conviction who left everything to come alongside Naomi, and I just think the world of her. It's like, no, leaves all that out. It's like, you also got to redeem Ruth the Moabite. And the guy says, oh, well, then I can't do that. And Boaz is like, yes. Okay, that's to come. But let's just see how this scene ends, because there's this interesting, again, the interesting little dialogue between Ruth and Naomi that kind of wraps up this part of chapter 2 that I want to just point out a couple things from. When she starts talking in verse 20. Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living and the dead." See, this is a pivotal moment in the theology and the understanding that Naomi has of God. Remember in chapter 1, she never doubts that God is there, but he's just taken everything from her. Her name used to mean pleasant, and she says, "I don't even want you to call me that anymore. Now just call me the bitter one. Because I'm back, but God brought me back completely empty." That is so different from what she's just said. She's just said now, the Lord, and I'll explain why I believe it's the Lord she's talking about, his kindness has not forsaken me. It doesn't actually forsake the living or the dead. That means like she's really looking back over the days of her life and gone, you know what? There were all these moments where I thought his kindness had forsaken me and I was wrong. And Ruth, I want you to understand that now you can trust in God because his kindness will never forsake you. Now, why do I think it's God's kindness, not Boaz's? In English, it solves the problem, actually, in my translation, because my translation says, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness." It seems very clearly in English that it's actually God's kindness she's talking about. But actually in the Hebrew, it's not nearly that clear. It leaves you wondering. It's like, is she talking about Boaz or God? Like, whose kindness is she convinced of here? And I think the answer is absolutely God. Number one, it's almost the exact same thing that Abraham in Genesis 24. Remember when Abraham sends out a servant to find a wife for his son? It's almost word for word. It's almost like she's quoting something that she grew up hearing the stories about, of how God had done this, how his kindness had not forsaken it. But it goes beyond that, because there is no way at this point in the story that Boaz could be showing kindness to the dead. It's just... later, you could make a case where you're like, well, if he married the widow, then there is kind of this act of kindness, maybe somehow to Elimelech, if you kind of, you know, squint and try to figure out how that maybe worked. But at this point, Boaz has no clue any of that's coming. And so Naomi simply says, there is a God who is kind, and he is never going to forsake you. Isn't that awesome theology? From the one who just a few verses later just can't see it. That's, by the way, what hopelessness does. It makes it so hard to see reality. So an aside, just a little moment. If you're there, you're saying, I feel hopeless, please reach out so we can pray with you and for you. Because when we're hopeless, we can't see the good that God maybe is doing. And we need people around us, people like a Ruth who says, you know what? I'll go and I will glean and I'll make sure there's something to eat. And I will trust that even when you can't see, there's still a God. And eventually Naomi comes around where she starts to understand there is a God and he is for us and he is kind and he never forsook us. Even in all those hard points, it doesn't mean the hard points just are minimized and they all just go away, but there's just something new and fresh that washes over Naomi at this point. In fact, so new and fresh, notice how her perspective changes. Up until this point, it's all Ruth. It's all Ruth's initiative. She's going out and gleaning. She's doing all the work. And all of a sudden, for the first time, it's like hope breaks through. And now Naomi says, I want to make sure, Ruth, that you're cared for. That's hope. It's serving others. It's a beautiful story. We got to end it there. But we will pick up next week. We have one of our missionaries here. I did not plan to preach one out of five Sundays. I guarantee you this. And the staff has ridiculed me sufficiently that you don't need to do it. It's just God's weird timing. But we will pick this up in 2 weeks and we will finish Ruth's story before we get to the end of June.